The Financial Times guides you through complex issues. In divisive times, don't settle for black and white. When you need the full perspective, turn to FT.com. Become a subscriber today. Search for FT subscription.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast. It's the 22nd of February 2018, and it's episode 1000. Thanks for listening if you have, for all those. I haven't. How are you kidding? By the way, it's as a sort of celebration of that, today we have on a very special guest, and it's Mark Cuban, a billionaire US investor. He's one of the sharks on Shark Tank, which is like our Dragon's Den, but it's bigger money over there. And Mark talks about how he went from being skint to a billionaire. He also talks about cryptocurrencies, his investments. He talks about Trump, talks about Brexit, and he was a very nice guy, and it was very nice to chat to him. Also on the podcast today, Graham Lumsden, CEO of MotiveBio, MTFB, and Graham speaks about the three Iclyprim abstracts that have been accepted for the presentation of the upcoming 28th European Congress of Clinical Microbiology and Infectious Diseases, and that's held in Madrid on April 21 to 24. Plus, I also have Jamal Rushdie, CEO of Collagen Solutions, and Jamal discusses their positive 8-year results of their chondromimetic cartilage repair clinical study. Plus, I also have on Stephen Blythe, CEO of Expedia, XPD is ticker there, and Stephen discusses their positive trading update for 2017. And as always, I have the top 5 most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours, and the top 5 most liked RNSs too.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is owner of Dallas Mavericks basketball team, a shark investor on ABC's Shark Tank, and one of the most respected businessmen in America. It's billionaire investor Mark Cuban. Mark, thanks for doing the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
I was reading about you, Mark, and I just assumed you came from a wealthy background, and that wasn't the case. You came from
No.
You came from quite a modest background, and you become a billionaire. Yeah. That's you know, it's very rare that anyone ever does that on this planet. And
well, I'm glad it was me.
The thing is that kind of success is hard to replicate. But if there's one sort of attribute you can put it down to, it took you from where you were to where you are today. What do you think it is?
Yeah, I mean, you got to find something that you love to do, be relentless at being as great at it as you possibly can, and recognize that there's going to be a lot of roadblocks and stumbles and, you know, backwards and forwards, but you just have to keep on grinding. And, you know, I'm not going to say anybody can become a billionaire. There was a lot of luck involved for me, but I do think that anybody can really reach their financial goals if they set their mind to it.
Yeah, so it's essentially hard work, perseverance, and keep on, and obviously doing something you love. Is that right?
Yeah, because you know what? If you don't like it, nobody ever quits anything they're good at. And if you're good at it and you love it, then, I mean, good things can happen. Look, when I was broke, I was living 6 guys in a 3-bedroom apartment. I was working as a bartender, then in sales. I still loved what I was doing, and I was having fun. But I was able to keep at it, even though I was broke, just because I loved what I was doing. And once I got into technology, and then I realized that this is something that's for me. I had an aptitude for it that I didn't realize, and I just started working harder and harder at it, but it wasn't work because I loved what I was doing.
Yeah. If someone sort of spoke to you at that age when you were broke and said, you know, in about 20, 30 years' time, you'll be owning a basketball team, you'll be on ABC's Shark Tank, you'll be a billionaire, would you believe them?
No, I would have told them, let's do another shot, let's do another beer, and then we could talk about it again, because we both would have had to have been drunk for me to even consider that.
I got to explain, over here it's called Dragon's Den, but you've been on Shark Investor since 2011, and you've invested, and you seem to do bigger money over there. You invest millions, and you've invested a total of 19.9 million. Is there a common theme amongst, you know, the companies you invest in?
Is there a common theme? Not a common theme per se. I mean, there's times when I'll invest in the entrepreneur. There are times when I just like the business idea and it fits my skill set, so I'll invest. And there are times when I just think it's the right thing to do for any number of different reasons. But it's a little bit different because of television. And so I probably cut the entrepreneurs a little bit more slack on Shark Tank than I would just in normal business dealings.
We obviously don't get the show over here, but what's been the biggest success from that? And has there been a real stinker? We thought, what was I thinking?
Oh yeah, I've probably invested in 70 plus companies over since, you know, the 8 years, whatever it is I've been doing the show. Mm-hmm. And so across the 70, there's been, I think, four that I've sold that have done really well. There's probably another probably closer to 10 now where I've made 5 to 10 times my money. And on the flip side, there are just some dumpsters, you know what I mean, that are just bad, you know, where, you know, because the way the show works is, you know, from Dragon's Den, we get maybe, you know, an hour to talk to them, then they edit it down for TV, mm-hmm. and then we get a chance to do due diligence after the fact. So you don't know as much as you'd like to about some of the companies. So some of them turn out to be bad, but that's just the way life works.
Looking at floated or listed stocks, are you sort of a regular sort of investor? I mean, on a personal book, or with you, if you're going to make an investment, do you have to tell a lot of people, or can you just, if you see a company you like, can you just go ahead and invest in it? What happens?
Yeah, if there's something I like, I'll just invest in it. And, you know, I'm a tech guy, so I typically tend to gear towards technology companies. So right now, my two biggest stock holdings are Amazon and Netflix.
Yeah.
And, I got a couple other dividend-paying stocks, but nothing very big. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, beyond that, I'm just really conservative.
Yeah. Okay. And so, I guess a lot of people who listen to this podcast like small cap stocks. You know, they like the chance of double, trebling, or even quadrupling their money. I mean, do you ever, you know, invest in smaller cap stocks at all?
Rarely. I used to more, but so what's happened over the past 20 years in the stock markets is there's so much money chasing fewer and fewer stocks. Like 20 years ago, there, at least in the U.S., there were 8,000 publicly traded stocks. Mm-hmm. Now there's fewer than 4,000. And back then, I don't even know how much money was in the market, but it's 10 times that much now. And so you have a lot smarter people chasing so many fewer stocks that, you know, if you're just, you know, when I would just trade stocks, right, I had to learn, and it was an expensive lesson sometime, that nobody's selling me a stock thinking it's going down, right? And you have to ask yourself, okay, why is this person or algorithm or whatever it may be on the other side selling me this stock? And what is it that I know that gives me an advantage? Do I understand this industry better? Do I understand this company better? Do I know the people at the company and I trust their management better? You know, what is it that makes me believe? And if your answer to that question is, I just think more people are going to buy it, and, you know, a lot of people are telling me about it, you might want to be careful, because typically in those situations, somebody's selling it to you for a good reason, which means they don't think it's going to go up.
Do you know what? It's often the case when people invest in a stock, they only think it's going to go up, and they never look at the bear case for it at all.
So I suppose, and then when they make a mistake, they don't get out fast enough, right? They think, I can't lose money. I can't lose money. Look, when you're wrong, you're wrong. You just got to own it and get out and move on to the next one. Too many investors get stuck thinking, well, you know, I paid $4 a share, or I paid 40 cents a share, and it's 25 cents a share, and all it's got to do is go up 15 cents and I'm back to even if it goes up 20 cents. Mm-hmm. But they fail to realize that there's 6 billion shares outstanding, you know, and it's hard to move even 15 cents when there's that many shares outstanding.
So going back a bit, what was the first deal you did when you thought, this is the big league now, I'm into the big league, I've done very well here? Do you remember that time when you thought, yes, I've sort of made it here, or on the way to making it?
Well, I mean, once I sold my company for billions, my first big deal was buying the Dallas Mavericks, and that was $285 million. So, you know, that was my big spend, and even to now, that's been my big spend. And that, and buying a plane. So I bought a G5, and, you know, that was probably those two things are probably the most fun things I bought. But along the way, you know, when I first got started and I went from broke to selling my first company, and I bought a small house, but then I bought a lifetime pass on American Airlines. And I would just fly everywhere, fly anywhere. You know, I'd go to London just to have drinks. I'd go to, you know, to Vegas. I'd go to, you know, Moscow, wherever I wanted to go just to have fun. That was probably the first step where I thought, you know what? You know, working hard and making money is not a bad thing. I can have some fun with this.
Yeah. Obviously, you talk about basketball there, and I was reading a bit about you. And obviously, we're not a huge basketball nation in the UK. But I was reading, your passion is very deep. Not only have you obviously bought that Mavericks, but, I mean, I've seen the amount of fines you've got from being on the court. So, the good thing is, though, Mark, when you're fined, you sometimes match that fine with
charity. Yeah, I always match it. It's kind of, manage the EPL and just how crazy the fans are and some of the ownership groups are there. Well, I guess you don't like a lot of the American owners over there, but some of the UK owners, yeah. that just get all excited. I just love the game. Yeah. But I'll tell you this, here's a secret for you. Mm-hmm. My second favorite sport,
yeah.
Rugby.
Is it?
Yeah, I played for a long time. And I mean, American rugby is nowhere near British or, you know, the All Blacks or anything like that. But, you know, I love the game. Absolutely love it.
Well, listen, I'm from Wales, and that's our national sport.
Sort of, absolutely.
In fact, we just lost to England last week, so that wasn't a good thing. But there we go. It was in England. It was in Twickenham, so they had a home advantage, I argue that.
Big-time home advantage,
yeah. Exactly. Let's move on to crypto. It's been crazy. You know, Bitcoin, the run it's had up to $20,000 and back down sort of $6,000, and it's back up to about $11,000. I mean, what's your thoughts on crypto, Mark?
You know, you've got to be careful. Look, I'm a fan of the blockchain. I've always been a fan of the blockchain. But crypto is kind of become a collectible. It's no different than collecting sports cars or collecting stamps or coins. It's the value right now is based on what somebody is willing to pay for it. And the more buyers, if you have more buyers than sellers, it's going up. If you have more sellers than buyers, it's going down. The challenge for crypto now in terms of the pricing is whether or not buyers can use margin. So what's happening, and you're getting a lot of small traders who come in and can't afford a whole Bitcoin, let's say at $10,000. Mm-hmm. So they put up $1,000 or they use credit or margin with their account, or they use their credit cards. And the good news of that is that it helps push the price up. The bad news is when things start going backwards, they get margined out. And all of a sudden, all these small traders have got to sell. So you're going to see a lot of volatility. Now, what is it truly worth? Well, it's going to depend. Are they going to really stick to only 21 billion, a million Bitcoins being released? Or is there going to be some other type of change as Lightning comes in or other things come in that expand the total amount? Is Bitcoin going to be the final winner, or Ethereum going to be the final winner, or Litecoin, whatever, you know, Bitcoin Cash? That's the uncertainty, because the technology is still in flux. Mm-hmm. So right now there's a lot of uncertainty, which means you're going to get a lot of volatility. But all that said, do I think crypto is going to be the currency of the future? No, I just think there's too many choices. But do I think it'll be a viable store of value or a viable transaction capability? Yes, I think, you know, particularly with blockchain, there'll be unique opportunities. So all of that's a long way of saying, if you're a gambler, this is like going to Las Vegas, or it's like going to a casino and putting your money on red. You know, Bitcoin could go to $100,000, it could go to $10, and it could all be in the same day. So if you're able to lose your money and you're willing to take a chance, great. Buy crypto. I own Bitcoin and I own Ethereum. Those are the only two.
Yeah.
But I don't trade them. I just put them away, pretend they're not there, and hope they go up.
Cool. And so when did you sort of get into those? Was that early on, or was it, or what?
No, I got into some early on. I mean, I bought like $50 worth like 6 years ago. But just so I understood it, I just opened up a Coinbase account, you know, which has done really well, but I didn't really get into it. I think I bought real amount of Bitcoin in October and Ethereum in November. Mm-hmm. So it's paid off for me, but, yeah. You know, I'm not in there trading in and out.
So you've obviously got a knack, Mark, of spotting a business that can do well, you know. And So what is it then? I mean, obviously people can sort of drill down into the balance sheets and all that, but when you're on Shark Tank, sure. And you see something, what is it? Is it the person? Is it the business? What is it that attracts you about a business?
All the above. I mean, it really depends. So, you know, Shark Tank's a little bit different. Let's just say general investing. So with tech, I try to ask myself, is this something that's going to change the world? Mm-hmm. And if it's going to change the world, how is it going to change it? Who's going to be out there competing with it? Who is going to create problems for it? And are these the right entrepreneurs to do it? And, you know, whether it's artificial intelligence, is it nanotechnology? You know, there's just so many different new things, precision medicine, that are coming up right now that it takes a lot of time to understand the tech. But because I'm willing to put in the time to understand the technology, I think I have a little bit of an edge to make investment decisions.
You must get pitched to quite a lot just off the cuff. I mean, has anyone ever pitched to you and you've said yes, or you've had a meeting with them and liked it, yeah?
Yeah. I mean, I get pitched everywhere, from the Lou to the you name it. I mean, people will pitch me any chance. Like, yeah, and look, you know, I can understand and I'm fine with it. But yeah, I've invested in companies that I've just met over email. You know, if you know a company, Box.com, it's a public company. Aaron Levy pitched me as an investor when he was still in college. He pitched me Box in 2005, and I gave him, I invested $250,000 without even having met him.
Wow. That's good. So as far as people, I mean, like you say, you are a billionaire, you're an exclusive club. And are there other sort of, you know, business people that you respect and think, this guy is sharp, I like him a lot? Who like?
Yeah, I mean, guys that I think are sharp are, you know, Bill Gates, you know, Warren Buffett, obviously. Mm-hmm. You know, guys I know fairly well that are incredible, like Mark Benioff from Salesforce.com, mm-hmm. Todd Wagner, who was a partner of mine, Bill Gurley, who's an investor. There's, you know, there's, the list goes on and on and on. There's, you know, the fascinating part is, you know, I can sit and talk to these folks, and they, you know, they're rich, but they're good people, and they'll share ideas and everything. But I, you know, but beyond that, you know, it's more about doing your own work.
Yeah.
You know, no one gives you any shortcuts. I think where a lot of people go wrong is they think if they only had a mentor or somebody to help them or somebody to guide them. And that's rarely the case. I mean, having a mentor is okay. I mean, maybe it can save you a couple steps. But in reality, if you're going to get it done, if you're going to get to the financial levels you want, you've got to be willing to put in the work. When all my buddies were going out, I mean, I went 8 years without taking a vacation when I had my first company. You know, I'd still go out and have fun, but, you know, while other people were taking vacations, I wasn't. While other people were going out, I was home reading, you know, or working on a computer, you know, writing programs and software. And I taught myself to write software. And so, you know, there are things that when I look at all these people who are really wealthy, the one thing that always tends to stand out is they focus on learning. They take it as a personal challenge to know more about what's going on in their industry or what's going on in some technology than anybody else. And they become maybe not experts, but really well-versed in that area. And that's the difference. Most people aren't willing to take the time. They think there's some shortcut. They think there's somebody they can talk to. There isn't. You got to dig in. You got to be obsessive about it. You've got to really be willing to learn and continuously learn, because there's always, and I say this to myself all the time, you know, there's always somebody out there. There's some 18-year-old girl or guy trying to kick my ass, right? Mm. And, you know, when I was that kid, I was trying to kick the old guy's ass, and, you know, now they're trying to get me. And the only way I'm going to stay ahead is by outworking them, and I'll still do that to this day.
I know sort of cutting through over here, getting highlights or a lot of attention, is Elon Musk at the moment. I mean, do you know Elon?
I've never met Elon. I've never met him, but I'm obviously a fan, because, you know, his ability to generate ideas and then follow up on them, and the fact that he goes all in, he puts up all his money, is phenomenal. So I give him a ton of credit.
Let's move on to politics a little bit. One question here on politics, because someone did ask you, a while back, if you're getting into the presidential race, and I think you get, you know, some good votes there. I think you should do it, because you're obviously a winner in that arena. But I saw that Trump sort of tweeted about Oprah, say she should take part. Yep. And do you think Oprah would make a good president?
I don't think she'd be better than what we have, but Oprah's smart. I mean, I like Oprah, and she's smart, and she's kind, and she knows what she doesn't know. I think, you know, one key, whether it's me or anybody else, one key element that's missing in the White House right now is, you know, our president doesn't know what he doesn't know and doesn't try to find out. Mm. You know, I've just been talking to you about learning in order to be good at something, and that's not something he understands at all. And I think, you know, whether it's Oprah or anybody else, I think if you get in a president that's smart and is capable of understanding what's going on in the country and, you know, understands that they're not going to know everything and gets help, then you can run the country, because our institutions are pretty strong. But if you've got somebody that is not very self-aware and doesn't have a whole lot of contextual awareness, then that's where you start to have problems. And, you know, you see it from over there. You know, that's why there's a lot of distrust for what's going on over here.
Well, do you know what? That's what we see of Trump. We see the tweets and we think, you know, a lot of tweets he puts out, I wouldn't tweet. And I'm thinking, I'm thinking, doesn't anyone tell this guy to put his phone away or something? Because it's unbelievable.
Of course they do. But that's the whole point, right? He's just, that's who he is. I mean, I don't know him well, but I know him fairly well. Mm-hmm. And that's just who he is.
Yeah.
And, you know, he never makes a mistake in his mind. It's always somebody else, and he can do no wrong. Mm. And if you can do no wrong, then everything that you tweet or say, you think is right. Mm. And, you know, that he's just, it's just something we have to deal with. And look, if you, my New Year's resolution was to press the mute button on Donald Trump and not look at his tweets and not, you know, not pay attention to that and just look to see what he does or doesn't do. And if you just look at what he has done or hasn't done, there's some things that, like any president or like any prime minister, you're going to look at and say, okay, I agree. And some things you disagree. And, you know, if he would just, if you just set aside all the stuff he says, because most people ignore that anyways, then okay, he's a marginal president. He's not as horrible as he sounds with all the tweets. So I've really tried to put him on mute, just look to see what happens and see what types of actions he's taking. And, you know, we'll see what happens from there.
Well, you know, since you're not a huge fan, but what is the feeling like in America? I mean, apart from the Trump supporters, is there like a lot of people like yourself thinking, you know, we'll just say like, we'll put him on mute for as long as we can. Is that the thought?
Yeah, I mean, you know, yeah, of course. It's like the UK, right? You guys are dealing with Brexit, right? Yeah. Should it happen? Did we reconsider? You know, it was, you know, you look at the election and you say, oh my goodness, what happened? And then you really start to think it through and you say to yourself, here we are. And, you know, we're going to try to make the best of it. But the reality is people just live their lives. Mm-hmm. You know, more people can tell you about Beyonce's twins than can tell you about our vice president or Brexit, right? Yeah. People just aren't that aware politically in this country. And, you know, if you just watch all the cable news networks that talk about politics all the time, then, you know, you think the world is going to hell in a handbasket. But, you know, 99% of the people in this country don't do that. They live their lives. They try to do the best for their families and they go from there. And I think, you know, like the UK, it's our people that are going to really make the difference. You know, he may be here for 4 years, but, you know, this country will go on a lot longer beyond him. And, you know, whether Brexit happens or doesn't happen, you know, the UK will go on a lot longer, this, with or without Theresa May, with or without Brexit. It's the same for both of us.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And just before I ask you one final question, I mean, I don't know what you see on Brexit or what the kind of, you know, footage you get. I mean, what are your thoughts on it? I mean, if you have any.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think it was a movement that most people in the UK got surprised by. That's my perception. Yeah. And then, like anything else, there are a lot of people in this country that weren't Donald Trump fans, but they wanted to send a message that we are tired of the same old, same old. You know, one of my friends here in Dallas, you know, in Texas, is a red state and voted for Donald Trump. And I was like, why would you vote for this guy? I mean, and I gave him all the reasons. He goes, look, Mark, let me just tell you this. He's in his 50s. He goes, I've been voting for politicians my entire life. Mm-hmm. And you know what that where that got me? It got me nothing. You know the definition of insanity? Doing the same thing over and over again, expecting different results. I'm not voting for a politician. And so everybody voted against politicians, in particular Hillary Clinton. And then all of a sudden we got Donald Trump and now we're dealing with the reality. And I think Brexit was the same thing. People were tired of being told what to do. People were tired of the same old, same old. And this was their chance to send a message that, you know, we want things to change. Now, like anything else, you've got to deal with the reality at some point. And that's what's happening over there with Brexit. And, you know, you're closer, obviously, to it than I am. But it sounds like, you know, people are having second thoughts and maybe there'll be another vote. And that'll give everybody a chance to, you know, say what's on their mind again. And I think, you know, even over here, Hillary Clinton got more votes. And who knows what would happen if there's a second Brexit vote. What do you think will happen? Do you think there's going to be another vote?
I don't know. I think people are tired of voting, you know, of referendums. And you've got, let's be honest, I mean, even if people did vote to make a stand, you know, that was the majority. And now if you overthrow that, then the majority of those people are going to be annoyed. You know, I mean, it has sort of parted the country. I know friends that are, you know, not speaking to each other. They've unfriended each other on Facebook because of it. It really has separated people, you know. And
same thing's happened here.
It's very controversial. And so I mean, just one thing. I mean, you have, I don't know if he was joking or not, but I mean, you did sort of mention, and someone said, why didn't you run for president? And I don't know if you were joking there, but do you have any ambitions in that area?
I mean, it's not my lifetime dream to be president. It's going to depend what happens in our midterm elections in November of 2018. If the Democrats win, then there's no reason for me to run, right? There will be balance and hopefully harmony and hopefully some reality. But if the Republicans win, then I'll have to give it a much more serious consideration. I think our country's ready for an independent candidate. I mean, we only have two major parties, right? And all the others are tiny and basically irrelevant. And I think people are so tired of the partisanship and the tribalism. You know, it's like you said, you know, people unfriended each other and became, you know, stopped being friends over Brexit.
Yeah.
The same is happening here, where Republicans and Democrats won't talk to each other, you know, where people would just avoid politics altogether. And I think there could be a place for an independent candidate. And so if I did run, it'd probably be as an independent. But I don't have to make that decision for a while.
Final question, Mark. You've achieved perhaps in your lifetime what many people won't achieve in 10 lifetimes. So what's left here now? Ambition-wise, what do you still want to do? What do you think, I need to do this? What's left?
Yeah, I just try to be opportunistic, right? I just try to keep on learning and helping and impacting. I guess, you know, trying to have an impact on communities and, you know, help, you know, make the world a little bit better place than what I found it. And, you know, I got three kids that are young, 8, 11, and 14. And, you know, like everybody, it doesn't matter how much money you have, you still worry about your kids' health. You still worry about their future. You worry about their well-being and, you know, trying to do things that make the world a better place for them.
Yeah.
You know, because no matter, it's funny, because no matter how much money you have, they always say you can't take it with you. And, you know, as I get older, it's like, shit. Yeah. You know, it's not about that. It's I got these three little human beings that I worry a whole lot more about, like anybody else, than I do about, you know, how much money I have in the bank. And so I think I'm going through that transition where, okay, let's try to do something for them instead of for me. And that's it's exciting, but it's also challenging.
Yeah, and I suppose when you have children, like you say, and you are very wealthy, that in itself carries a whole lot of problems, doesn't it? You know.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's better than being broke.
Yeah.
In a big way. You know, I whenever someone says, "Oh, it's tough to be rich," I'm like, "Yeah, get over it." Mm-hmm. But at the same time, yeah, it scares me. I, you know, like I tell them, I don't want them to grow up and be entitled jerks. You know, I don't just give them money. I make them earn it. And, you know, it's very clear to them that they're going to have to get jobs. And, you know, they're going to be minimum wage jobs so that they understand what it's like to have to work and what it's like, you know, to have to pay your own bills. And, you know, I'll never, you know, there'll always be that cushion and they'll know it. And, you know, you can't fake that. But, you know, they certainly already know that they're going to have to earn their own way and learn their own way.
Mark, it's been great to chat to you, and I really do appreciate you taking the time out, because I know you're a busy guy.
My pleasure.
You know, it's our 1,000th episode, and thanks for taking up the offer there and coming on. And hopefully, you never know, we may speak again, and I may be standing there in front of you on Shark Tank. You never know, but...
I hope so. Bring it on. Good luck with the podcast, and congratulations.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Graham Lumsden, Chief Executive Officer of Motif Bio, that's MTFB. Graham, thanks for joining me.
You're very welcome, Justin.
Yeah, we haven't had a chat for a while, so it's very good to catch up. And you've released some news, some significant news about progress of the company. And we'll get into that in a bit. For people listening, though, Graham, right now, who are not aware of what you do at Motif Bio or the company, summarise, please, if you could, what you're all about.
Yeah, Motif Bio is all about developing new antibiotics that are effective against some of these multi-drug resistant or so-called superbugs that are causing problems in people in hospital. So we have a compound called Iclopren, which has finished the last stage of clinical development. So we've just completed 2 phase 3 trials, and we're on track for regulatory submissions this year and hopefully an approval later this year in the United States, and probably next year an approval in Europe. So late stage antibiotic development focused on serious and life-threatening infections in the hospital.
Yeah, absolutely. And you've announced you to present data at the ECCMID 2018. So for people like me and other people who are not aware of what this is and the significance, can you explain this, please, Graham?
Yes, absolutely. So ECCMID, as we call it, if you look at last year's ECCMID conference, which was in Vienna, more than 12,000 people attended that conference from 126 countries. It's called the European Congress of Clinical Microbiology and Infectious Disease. So basically, it's 12,000 of your nearest and dearest infectious disease doctors from around the world. So we think that's a really good target audience for us to be able to present our data. And as we said in the press release this morning, Motif Bio has had 3 abstracts accepted, and Professor Tom Lodice, who spoke at our September Analyst Day last September, is presenting some of his data also at this same conference. So we're very excited about that. Great audience, and we're glad that we got all these abstracts accepted for presentation.
So what ideally are you hoping to achieve or get out of these this kind of meeting here, this kind of presentation then, Ren?
Right. So the main thing is these are prescribing doctors from all over the world. They're eager to learn about new antibiotics like Eclipram. And so the four presentations that we're giving will give these attending doctors a good sense of what Eclipram can do in a phase three study. So that's the first abstract that's been accepted. Mm-hmm. This is the second of our two phase three trials. So we'll go over the results in approximately 600 patients. We'll have more detail than has previously been publicly disclosed. We've so far just announced top line results. So there'll be more detail for that first one. That's an oral presentation. Mm-hmm. The second one is absolutely critical in today's healthcare environment, where people are very, very focused on the cost of healthcare. And what we're presenting in the second abstract is data that shows that if the right patients are treated with Eclipram, it can actually be cost-saving for the healthcare systems. And we think that's really, really important mm-hmm. in today's environment. The third one is an update on bacteria that are collected from all over the world. We do this regularly, frequently, to make sure that Eclipram is still working against the bacteria that are present in hospitals. And this is showing that the very latest set of bacteria that were collected remains sensitive to Eclipram, so Eclipram kills them. And then the one from Professor Lodice, again, this is really important to our positioning of Eclipram, so it's critical for these infectious disease specialists to appreciate that, according to the data that Professor Lodice has gathered, vancomycin causes acute kidney injury if it's used in certain patients. And the problem, two problems with acute kidney injury. First of all, the patient's mortality risk, so the risk of dying, moves up from 5% to 19%. And then tying back into what I was saying earlier about the economic advantages, the cost savings opportunity, patients who get acute kidney injury caused by vancomycin, which is a very old antibiotic that's been around since 1958, but still gets used unbelievably in the hospital. Mm-hmm. The additional problem is, on average, according to Professor Lodice's data, it costs the hospital an additional $17,000 per patient because of the acute kidney injury. They have to spend longer in hospital. They require a specialist nephrologist consultation. They require dialysis. So these are critical messages to get over to position Eclipram appropriately and describe to these infectious disease doctors who is the Eclipram patient once we get an approval and it's on the market available for them.
Yeah, so why does that happen when you say that it's like the same medication has been used since, what was it, the 80s or the 50s you just said?
Vancomycin is a very old antibiotic, was first introduced to the market back in 1958. It works for some patients. It's just doesn't have a very good safety profile in people who have some degree of kidney damage with or without diabetes, because unfortunately vancomycin is excreted through the kidneys, and if somebody has damaged kidneys, it doesn't get eliminated from the body properly, and it builds up and causes toxicities. So that's why Eclipram is a real step forward. The unmet need is patients who don't do well on vancomycin. That's where Eclipram can fill an unmet need.
Yeah, absolutely. And so in those situations where you say it may not be appropriate for certain patients, vancomycin, why is it then prescribed? Is it just the habit that they've always done that, and that's what's always the results have been okay, or what's the deal there?
Yeah, it's habit. It's they believe it's inexpensive because it's been around for so long. It's generic, so it doesn't cost much for the hospital to purchase vancomycin. Mm-hmm. The problem is, if it causes acute kidney injury, you have to add $17,000 per patient to the cost of the drug. And thirdly, there hasn't been a good alternative for physicians to use instead of vancomycin, and that's why we're so excited about the potential of Eclipram.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, excellent stuff. Graham, well, so if someone's listening to this and likes the sound of what you're talking about and where you're headed, but are not following this story yet, give them three quick reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page on Vox Markets and add you to their watch list, please.
Okay, so number one, we expect to submit a new drug application to the Food and Drug Administration in the United States for a new hospital antibiotic called Equiprim by the end of March of this year. And that should lead to a decision, obviously, hopefully an approval before the end of 2018. And if it's an approval, we would be able to launch early in 2019. So late stage with a new antibiotic called Equiprim. Secondly, there's a compelling unmet medical need that Equiprim, we think, can help with. These are complicated patients who right now are at high risk of developing acute kidney injury if they get treated with the standard of care antibiotic vancomycin. Acute kidney injury elevates mortality risk, and it's highly costly to the healthcare systems. So we think Equiprim can be a better alternative than vancomycin in patients at high risk of acute kidney injury. And lastly, in an increasingly cost-conscious healthcare environment, Equiprim may indeed be cost-saving in these patients who are at high risk of vancomycin-induced acute kidney injury.
Marvellous stuff, Graham. Good to chat to you, and hopefully we'll chat again in the not-too-distant future. Thanks very much.
You're welcome. Thanks, Justin.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Jamal Rushdie, Chief Executive Officer of Collagen Solutions at COS Ticker. Jamal, thanks for joining me.
Oh, thank you, Justin. Great to join you as well.
Yeah, and you've had some significant news out of late, and we'll get to that in a bit. Before we do, for people listening right now, Jamal, that have not heard of Collagen Solutions, can you summarize what you're all about, please?
No, I'd be happy to. We're in the biomedical space. Collagen Solutions supplies and develops and manufactures biomaterials for use in regenerative medicine. And these are biomaterials such as collagen, tissue, and other constructs to help regrow human tissue.
Wow. Okay. And so you've recently announced positive data from Collagen Solutions' proprietary product, which is a chondromimetic. It's a hard one to say, but can you first explain what chondromimetic is, please, Jamal?
Yes, I'd be happy to. So chondro meaning the surface of the knee, mm-hmm. and mimetic is to mimic that surface. Mm-hmm. It was a project that was started nearly 20 years ago. It was a joint effort between MIT in the United States and Cambridge University in the UK. It's an implant or a scaffold that's made of collagen, ceramic, and some other molecules. And the intent here is to regenerate the cartilage in the knee. So everybody probably knows somebody or has had themselves a knee problem where you have to have a surgery. So this is meant to restore that cartilage and in an early intervention stage such that you don't have to have secondary surgeries down the road and you can turn to pain-free function.
Wow, that's impressive, because I know people have had, like you say, knee operations, and I've had knee problems myself running. But I mean, my father had one, and he said, if you can avoid having knee surgery, it's the best thing you can do, because it's not any easy sort of job, is it? It can, have some complications further down the line.
Absolutely, and you've hit the nail on the head. I'm a runner myself, so looking forward to this product working down the road. But typically, these knee surgeries, early intervention, they don't last much more than 2 years. 2 years, you can get good pain relief, maybe three. Mm-hmm. But a lot of the current techniques, after about 5 years, you may have to have another surgery or it doesn't quite hold. So what's significant about the data that we're announcing today, morning, is that this data is 8-year long-term follow-up showing sustained results. So this is very exciting in the cartilage repair space. It does demonstrate that beyond that 5-year, that critical 5-year time point, we have a therapy that is sustainable over the long term. And that's going to impact potentially millions of people around the world who suffer from knee pain and have to have multiple surgeries.
Yeah. So how do you think this kind of procedure will be adopted by orthopedic surgeons?
Well, that's a great question. What's important when we're launching a new product, a new therapy, is to ensure that it fits within the current surgical technique as much as possible so the adoption can be higher and the learning curve lower. The beauty of this design that came out of MIT and Cambridge is that it is very, very similar to a surgeon's existing technique and protocols, rehab, etc. The training, while there is some training involved, it is very similar to what they do today, and it is a single surgery. Some of the other products that are effective over 5 years do take multiple surgeries, and they're much more complex. So this is a different niche. It's for an earlier stage intervention, very straightforward, simple technique. Targeted a price that will be very cost competitive, roughly 10% of some of these more expensive therapies. So we're looking from a cost perspective, this be from a health economic perspective, very attractive, and also from a surgeon ease of use and training curve, very attractive. We think for both those reasons, not just surgeons, but the healthcare systems around the world will find this very attractive.
I see. And so what are your next key milestones here?
Well, this is data. This was a key milestone for us to understand the 8-year follow-up, which is very significant. What we have to do now is receive approval in the European markets, and it's called the CE mark. Mm-hmm. We've started that submission process with our regulator in Europe. That will take most of this year. Our target is to have the CE mark approved by the end of this year. And so our next steps is to provide further information to the notified body, submit these clinical data and some other data. The other next step that we're working on is having the discussions with potential distribution partners as well as strategic partners so we can commercialize this in Europe.
Excellent stuff. And you've also announced a partnering deal in South Korea in December. Now, what activities should we expect in this territory over the next 12 months, Jamal?
Yeah, we were very happy about that. That announcement came in December of last year, so just at the end of the year. And it's a partner that is very interested in this regenerative medicine space, great access to hospitals. What we've been doing is the regulatory and reimbursement assessment, which are very critical in South Korea. We have a fairly good view initially on this. We will be meeting with our South Korean partners just here after the South Korean New Year. They are coming to our site in Glasgow, and we're going through a deep dive plan for those next steps in regulatory submissions as well as reimbursement submissions so we can begin that process in South Korea.
Excellent. And generally, I mean, can you give us a sense of the size of market in Europe or in the US or around the globe?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. So it is, it's a market that has to be developed. And one of the reasons that it needs to be developed is before now, there haven't been great cost-effective solutions that demonstrate long-term results. Mm-hmm. But what we're targeting is there's roughly 1 million cartilage procedures done a year. And these are procedures that are simple arthroscopies, again, that may buy the patient 2 or 3 years. But not have those long-term sustainable results. We have a fairly ambitious view that the global market for this can be quite tremendous. The target is if we can address about 30-40% of these procedures, it could be certainly a $500 million opportunity, roughly, potentially even more. Now, the challenge is we'll have to launch in a staged fashion. First, we'll start with Europe, and that typically is roughly 30-50% of the global markets. The U.S. is obviously a much bigger market, and Asia is interesting. Asia, we're starting in South Korea as a reference point. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of innovation, especially in cartilage therapy, that happens in South Korea. There's been some other companies that have announced new deals in Japan and otherwise, but there's a lot of interest in regenerative medicine in Asia. So, again, very ambitious potential goals here. We won't be coming to the United States for several years. That's going to take further clinical trials, but we think we have an immediate opportunity in Europe and then followed closely behind that in Asia.
Excellent stuff. And you are hosting an investor evening very soon on February the 26th. So give us the details. What can investors expect, and where is it, Jamal?
Oh, yes, thank you. So the details of what we'll be going over are to go over a presentation that we've put together to understand more deeply the information that we're provided in the study, to have a very interactive conversation with the investors in terms of Q&A of what does this mean, what does this mean for the business, and also I'm going to give some other updates on the business in terms of, you know, where we've some other recent announcements, for example in China. That is on the 26th of February. I am coming over to London, and we've put all the information up on our website. In terms of the venue and so forth.
Excellent stuff. And also it will be filmed, isn't that right, for the website, so people can see it afterwards, is that right?
That's correct. It will be filmed at, and we will be hosting it on our website so people can see the presentation.
Excellent stuff. Okay, Jamal, well, if someone's listening to this and likes the sound of what you're doing and this exciting new space but are not yet following the story, please give them three reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page on Vox Markets and add you to their watch list, please.
Oh, sure, Justin. So I think the first thing is this is a very dynamic business that is touching a number of markets within medical technology. So the news flow over the next 12 to 24 months should be very exciting. Not only do we have this opportunity with Chondromimetic, we've got investments in Asia Pacific that we're growing. We've got an area in spine surgery that's coming up. Wound care, which is another significant market, we've got a product in that area. So there's a number of very exciting regenerative medicine technologies that are coming through into the pipeline. We'll be continuing to update the market as well as growing our business. We have some ambitious goals and we look forward to updating the market on. We're very early in the business, so it'll be very exciting to watch our growth over the next few years.
Excellent stuff. Jamal, good to chat to you, and hopefully we'll catch up in the not too distant future. Thanks very much.
Well, thank you, Justin.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Stephen Blythe, CEO of Expediator. That's XPD ticker. Stephen, thanks for joining me again.
Yes, good morning.
Now, before we get, you've released a trading update, which looks very good. We'll get into that in a bit. Before you do, though, for people listening and they've not heard of the company, explain, summarise, Stephen, what's Expediator all about, please?
Expediator is a business which was set up over 30 years ago and is basically a freight management business operating primarily in road freight within Europe, in Eastern Europe, which are expanding areas. We have three main divisions, which are freight forwarding division, which moves anything from textiles to industrial goods across Europe. We have an affinity division, which provides fuel cards and cross-channel ferries to over 1,500 truckers running 11,500 vehicles. And we have a third division, which is our logistics and warehousing division, which is building up a lot of e-commerce activity, particularly strong into the Romanian area, where we have the franchise for Palex. Very successful development that over the last 5 years. We're now moving over 50,000 pallets around the country per month. That is leading us into doing more warehousing in that country.
Excellent stuff. Well, and you've released a trading update for 2017, which has gone well. Well, it's revenue up 59% to £116 million. You must be quite pleased with this.
Yeah, it's been an interesting year, 2017. And a huge compliment to the team that we've managed to do such good organic growth, as well as three acquisitions in the year, and also despite having all the distraction of doing a listing. So fantastic achievement from the team. Shows the depth of the management and the quality of the people we have working with us.
Yeah, well, I mean, like I said, it obviously has been a busy year. And so just pick out some key achievements, if you can, Stephen, from the year.
We changed our policy in Europe, trying to do more full load movements. That is reflected in the increase in turnover organically. One of the key achievements we had was obviously the listing. We joined AIM in August at 24 pence. The share price has been moving quite nicely. We went back to market in November to raise a further 2.8 million. And it's been a transformational year for us. So we've got the foundations in place now for sustained growth, and we're poised to go into 2018 to carry on the good work.
Yeah.
I have to say, this year, I've been working over 40 years, and this year I'm tingling with excitement as to what we can do. It's going to be absolutely fascinating.
That is good to have that kind of passion, and it's obviously a building block for success, that kind of passion. So are general marketing conditions very good, or is it just because you are taking advantage and you are doing better than competitors? What is it, Stephen?
Well, we have a great team. We're working in some good areas in Central and Eastern Europe, which are growth areas. Romania as a country has excellent the highest GDP growth, I think, in Europe. We've got a great team. We are competitive, and we work hard to build a business. And they're the basic ingredients. We've also got a huge spread of customers. We've got over 10,000 customers.
Yeah.
So when we tend to get them, we tend to keep them.
See, you're across Europe, and I know some people are probably thinking, okay, so it's going very well for you. So will there be any sort of challenges posed by Brexit and the customs union? Because there's a lot of confusion on that. What's your thoughts on that, Stephen?
Brexit for us will be an opportunity. In the past, in Romania, before they joined the EU, we were making over $1 million a year on customs clearances net in that country. The acquisition of Benfleet towards the end of last year has given us a presence in Dover. We will be ready for a soft or hard Brexit, WTO, whatever comes along. We see it as an opportunity for us to make more money. So we don't see the activity going in and out of the country dropping off. People will still buy their cheeses and their BMWs, etc. We'll be able to export as a country. We are well placed. We understand customs clearances. We were dealing with it in the past when it was much more problematic than it's likely to be. So we are in a good position to make money when it happens.
Wow. Well, that's interesting, because I know people are, you know, some people will maybe be looking at companies that are Brexit-proof, and you're not only Brexit-proof, but it seems like you will benefit from this. So
we'll make money.
Yeah, that's very interesting.
We will make money out of Brexit.
Yeah, yeah, wow, okay.
Yeah.
All right, well, Stephen, it's good to chat to you, but for people listening right now, they like the sound of what you're doing and the progress you've made, but they're not following the story. Give them three quick reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page on Vox Markets and add you to their watch list, please.
Well, we are, as you can see from last year, we grew the business very well organically. We will be doing more of that this year. I haven't got the shackles of doing listing, dealing with lawyers, etc. And I think it's going to be so exciting what we can deliver this year, both organically and also by continuing the policy of M&A activity. We've strengthened the team. We have a new CIO, Michael, who has had vast experience working at Tesco's in the past. He joined us onto the operating board and will be heavily involved in our e-commerce activity, particularly eShop WeDrop. That is going to be a terrifically exciting thing, and I'm taking a personal involvement in that one. So more of the same. The other thing is, as a business, we will maintain our policy of paying out 50% of earnings after tax. So when we make the money, we like to distribute it. So shareholders should hopefully continue the good growth.
Excellent stuff, Stephen. Good to chat to you, and hopefully we'll chat again in the not-too-distant future. Thanks very much.
Fantastic. Okay, I'm sure we will.
Okay, it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. They are at five.
EVR Holdings, that's EVR H ticker, at 4, Tlou Energy, T-L-O-U. Coming up soon, I have an interview with Tony Gilby, the managing director of Tlou Energy. At 3, New Oil and Gas, Newog. At 2, Visarian, I chatted to Neil, the CEO yesterday, VRS. And number 1, most followed company, again, is UKOG, UKOG, United Oil and Gas, after they've had quite a big fall. Okay, time for the top 5 most liked RNSs. They are at 5, Thor Mining, Holdings and Company. At 4, Starcom Trading Statement. Really? They took a big dive after that. At 3, Metal Tiger, MTR, On Market Purchase, Thor Mining. At 2, Codal Minerals, Further High-Grade Lithium Results, Marley. And do you know what's worth looking at this company? I've written a blog on them. I'm pretty quite biased, but do some research. They're in lithium, of course. Excellent results coming out. They have a Chinese partner who pumped like 4.5 million into the company, or 4.8 million into the company. So they have cash there, no problem at all. They've also got a gold assets, and the gold is looking very good. They're about 13, 11 million market cap, 12 million. They've got a lot of cash, and it's looking very good. So worth looking. I mean, if you want to get some exposure, and I've done that, I'll just try to get exposure to metals and materials that'll be big during this EV revolution, electrical vehicle revolution. And they're looking to push 30% of all sales of cars should be EV by 2030. So 30 by 30. So Codal is in lithium. It's worth getting exposure to that. Other stocks or minerals or metals worth getting exposure to, I think, in the next few years, is nickel, of course, copper, as always, graphite. Didn't know that. Did you know there's between 10 and 30 times more graphite in a lithium iron battery than lithium? Yeah, and nickel, so there's more nickel than this is. So nickel as well, with cobalt. So that's Codal Minerals, second most liked RNS. And at number 1, hoping to speak to Tony Gilby very soon, the managing director of Tlou Energy. That's interim announcement there. That's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. I'm 1,000th episode. Didn't think I'd make it this long, and it's been a very enjoyable process. Like I said, it's my passion, and I used to work in radio, and I've combined basically my obsession with stocks and shares with my passion for radio, and I put it together and managed to carve out a little niche here, and I'm glad you appreciate it, because I enjoy it. I'm glad you enjoy what I do. If you do enjoy it, thanks very much for listening. That's it for the podcast. Muchos apreciados.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Hear the intriguing stories behind some of the world's best love songs in the FT's Life of a Song podcast. From soul to funk, to punk to jazz, discover how classic songs like Smells Like Teen Spirit, Yesterday, and Stairway to Heaven were born. Search online or listen at ft.com/podcasts. Plus, don't miss the new Life of a Song book, featuring a compilation of 50 songs that have appeared in FT weekend columns. Pick up your copy from Amazon, your local bookshop, or give a gift to someone who'd enjoy this brilliant literary mixtape.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.